Hi, I'm the Dark Tangent, and you're about to listen to some speeches from DEF CON 2, held at the Sahara Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1994, July 22nd to the 24th. This speech and all speeches are copywritten, the Dark Tangent and DEF CON Communications, all rights reserved, except permission is granted for educational nonprofit use. Now, the Sahara, like most other hotels DEF CON's been at, has since been blown up to make way for a bigger and better hotel. So with that in mind, sit back, relax, get ready for some good speeches.
Okay. So that some of y'all had a chance to read some of our literature, hopefully, over the last day or so. What I want to do, is kind of cover some of the context of it, and then we'll go into more some of the technical aspects. Because basically, information without context is virtually useless, and that's pretty evident in most of our news programs because there's absolutely no context in the evening news from CBS or any other place. I guess I've had the distinction, as far as I can tell, of being threatened with the largest fine from the FCC for micropower broadcasting, or pirate broadcasting, as they term it. They threatened me with a $20,000 fine. They call it a notice of apparent liability. Our legal team came back and said, apparently not. So that's still tied up in the administrative process right now. We don't know when we're going to get a court challenge on that or not, but they don't seem to want to push the issue very heavily because they might lose. Well, at least we're optimistic that they might, but given the court system in this country, that's somewhat dubious as well. My lawyers are more optimistic than I am. Anyway, what I want to talk about first off is this whole aspect of communications and why we're doing what we're doing. Basically, it has to do with this, the whole nature of communications itself. And people wonder, well, what does micropower broadcasting have to do with the internet? What does that have to do with some these other aspects of things? Well, What our concern is not only with micro broadcasting, we have an organization we've started called the Free Communications Coalition. We call it the People's FCC. We like making digs at them as much as possible. They have no sense of humor. Most of you found most federal agencies and their minions do not have a sense of humor, and that's one of their major failings. Because it denotes a certain rigidity that causes a certain myopia and certain blindness and makes them very vulnerable to certain tactics and actions that I don't have to elaborate for this audience. Anyway, what communication is all about, everyone has an innate desire to communicate with each other. I mean, it's what being human is all about. And when that desire to communicate is frustrated, things get weird, just as other basic human drives get frustrated and not allowed a natural route of expression. So what we're really facing here is a situation where communication has been cut off. That is, we allow ourselves to become more isolated and not be able to communicate with each other, and therefore that makes us more manipulable. It also allows us not to find out what's happening with other people. And this is why the net is such a valuable and wonderful resource that's got to be protected against the encroachment by government and corporate interests to make it not so. And we see the net being a vital link in what one might describe an evolving infrastructure of dissident communication as a part of an overall movement across the planet to throw off this corporate government yoke around everyone's neck, and that they want to put under the aegis of the New World Order, well, we call it the New World Order. It smells like the same old shit. Anyway, we're seeing a reaction around the world to this in Chiapas and attempts of workers to fight back all around. That really what it's going to come down to is we don't have the information and tools necessary to fight back. And is human and personal freedom a worthy goal for fighting for? Or are we going to allow the corporations to extend the same bland, gray, three-piece suit mentality across the entire planet? Not to diss anybody's bigger eating habits, but sun never set on the flag of the British Empire. Now the sun never sets on the golden arches of McDonald's. It's the same sort of hegemonic impulses that drive both. And this is where communication, people cannot really get a handle on what's happening and seeing that, well, it's like a three number of blind men and an elephant. They've got an elephant in the room, you've got people who are vision impaired, to use a PC term, and they all try to figure out what they've got a hold of. One's got a hold of the trunk, one's got a hold of the tail, one's got a hold of the leg, and they can't figure out what they've got a hold of because they don't have all the pieces of the information to make an accurate assumption about what's in the room with them. Same thing's true with communication. If the communication systems are all under corporate and government control, you don't know whether you're dealing with an elephant or a dragon or what. And this is the situation we're in. And the context is that what we're looking at is that all these areas that were, whether broadcast, airwaves, which is a public resource, just like the natural resources we have on the planet, old growth forests, which are being totally ripped out by the corporations for pure profit and gain, selling grandeur, much to the detriment of life on the planet as a whole, much as everything else that's a natural resource has been appropriated, and the people who originally lived on that land are enslaved and put in concentration camps called reservations. And it's really life versus anti-life, and that's why we hope that this thing will win out, that life is chaotic, it's unpredictable, and that will eventually the systems that they're trying to create due to their inherent contradictions and internal dialectic or whatever you want to call it will fail. And we hopefully can encourage that process by whatever means are necessary. But as my background as an activist, I've been in the streets since the late 60s against the Vietnam War, and I believe in an ongoing struggle against these forces that want to restrict and control our lives and want to exploit the resources of this world, exploit the people, repression. I find it rather ironic that someone who sent up here yesterday morning, this woman who was, I guess, who I understand led Operation Sun Devil, and talk about, in the same sentence, use the words morality, ethics, government, and corporations. Mind you that these are the same people who brought you exploding gas tanks and Pintos, the Vietnam War, the overthrow of the Allende government, the overthrow of many governments around the world, toxic dumping, strip mining, old growth devastation, etc. So for these people to talk about trying to bring morality and ethics into a situation that they want to have control over is highly ludicrous at best. I don't think the old song goes about Jesse James that outlaws I think have a certain ethic of their own, and I think Robin Hood was right. So what we're really trying to deal with here is to get control back over our own lives, really. This is what communication is all about. We cannot share with each other, whether it's sharing information of whatever nature, whether it's sharing cultural and artistic expression, anything like that. We really don't have control of our lives, and it's unless we take control of the means of communication and see them as something we own collectively as a people on the planet, and not something to be used for private corporate gain or used as a means of control and manipulation by various governments and corporations, then we're going to be in serious trouble. And this is what we're trying to do with the micropower broadcasting movement, to show that one aspect of communication, broadcasting, is a public forum space subject to the same principles of free speech, of human rights, etc., that it should come first as a means of fostering communication, fostering democratic process between all peoples. And if there's any space left over, then it might be used for corporate interest. As as an individual in this country, you have rights, in theory, although when you try to find out about that, you find you sort of get the wrong end of a riot stick against your head. Or you find someone knocking you with search warrants, but because you got the wrong software on your computer system for some reason, or something to that effect. So the corporations, by and large, do not have rights. They have privilege, but unfortunately courts in the latter part of this century seem to be granting essentially de facto rights to corporations. That is, they don't have what is a right ascribed to you, that is the right to vote, etc., but they do vote. They do vote with billions of dollars every day, and that's pretty evident what's going on. So how do we counteract this when they control the media, when they control the access, etc.? Well, we control it with something like this. This is how we gain back. This is a little 5-watt FM transmitter. Like it's available with kits. We've sold about 300 transmitter kits since the end of last summer in this country. And we see this as an integral part linked with the net as well. What we would like to see is an evolving, decentralized, highly decentralized, loosely coupled, widely distributed communications network around this country and around the planet, consisting of micropower transmitters operating FM, AM, and TV, coupled with the net and any other communications that we can evolve. Because that way we can share programs, we can digitally record them, compress them, put them up on the net, so people around the world can hear other people's programs. This is now a growing thing on the net, internet talk radio, whatever they want to call it. So that we can use these communication tools for cultural enrichment, for personal freedom enrichment, to evolve the decentralized communities that really would make life a much better situation on the planet for everyone, instead of some hierarchical situation where all the arguments really devolve down to it's who's going to be in control. It's not a question of anything else. These, all the arguments now with the net are being brought up about, well, who's going to control it? Well, the net shouldn't be controlled by anyone, nor should any other means of communication be controlled by any one entity. That's the beauty of the net. It's probably one of the purest forms of anarchy I think exists, and I think it should be allowed to continue in that form without government or corporate intervention in any level, shape, or form. Because it's the right to communicate any way we so choose with each other without interference of anyone. And until governments recognize that right, they can just, you know, get the hell out of the way. So, you know, perhaps I'm bringing more of political context into, you know, more of a technical gathering, but you have to understand that the situation we're looking at is one of historical context, but there's always been attempts to control. The Radio Corporation of America was essentially set up to essentially steal the radio patents of many inventors who spent countless hours and sweat and toil doing research and design. But the government said, well, we got this chaotic situation here, obviously out of control, and we have to control it. So you inventors out here, you designers, are going to have to give up your patents for due compensation, of course, to the Radio Corporation of America. This is in the early beginnings of radio. So that's how, and of course David Sarnoff and all that, how they made their fortune, essentially, because the government mandated everyone else had to give their patents to RCA. So, you know, we see the same things involving today, the same type of control issues. And in terms of free speech, whether you know it or not, your right to speak publicly in a park was not recognized as a free speech right, even though this was established in the Constitution almost 200 years ago. The adoption of the U.S. Constitution, anniversary of September 17th of this year. But your right to speak publicly in a park was not codified and protected, in theory, by the Supreme Court from the 1930s, some hundred and some odd years after the fact. Our strategy in the micropower broadcasting movement is looking at it from two perspectives. One, we're willing to pursue a legal route to challenge it, and then those who are willing to be guinea pigs like myself who say, all right, yeah, we'll take the risk and we'll do this. Is only looking at. The other thing is that, in my opinion as an activist, is that direct action gets the goods, in more cases than not. And that means if we have enough people going on the air with small, low power transmitters across the country, it's going to be impossible for them to deal with this, basically, because the FCC has limited resources, limited budget, limited amount of people. And they can buy all the fancy cars and communication vehicles they want, but that's not going to be enough. And it's similar to the free speech fights of the early 1900s of wobbly labor organizers. What would happen, it was rather a humorous situation in certain respects, except unfortunately people were killed and injured and died as a result. Freedom and freedom at the price here, folks. What would happen is that it was very difficult time, especially on the West Coast in the 1900s, for workers. They were highly exploited, a lot of immigrant workers, just like now, not much different, except they spoke the Swedish accents instead of Latino accents. And they worked in lumber mills, they worked in lumber camps, they worked in sweatshops all up and down the Northwest Coast. And, of course, they were able to organize themselves. And people would come into town to start organizing the workers. And what would happen is if somebody would be up on the street corner, they'd start talking about the oppressive conditions people were working under. And they would start speaking about this. And sure enough, the sheriff or police chief, whoever happened to be there at the time, at the behest of usually the people that owned the means of production, the factory owners, et cetera, would send the people on and say, well, we can have this kind of rabble rousing, and they'd be arrested. Well, these are the people they arrest were Wobblies, IWW, Industrial Workers of the World. And so what would happen is the network was very good. They had their own net, so to speak. And within a week, the whole town would be filled up with other Wobbly organizers. They'd all line up behind a soapbox, and they'd get up the soapbox. My fellow workers, and of course the sheriff and his deputies would be there, and that person would be hauled off to the jail. Next person would get up. This would go on for hundreds of people would be lined up, and the jails would be filled with the bursting of Wobbly labor organizers. And they start singing. I mean, they were great songwriters and great singers, and they would do this 24 hours a day, until they were hoarse and couldn't, be hardly heard. And it was like such a ruckus and din. In a lot of cases, the judges live next door to the jail, and they keep the judge up all night with this. And eventually, there were victories because there were so mass number of people demanding their free speech rights, the courts finally gave in. Although it was tentative, organizers would find themselves at the point of a shotgun in the middle of the night somewhere on a dark road, too. But this is kind of a struggle it's always been. I mean, whether it's been these free speech fights in Portland or Corvallis, or it's been the desegregation efforts in Selma. It's always taking bodies in the streets to effectively change the situation. Government has never responded to reason, thought, and well-crafted dialectic. It's always taken the threat of total chaos and anarchy to bring it to some semblance of the bargaining table, at the very least the threat of economic loss. That's why the desegregation efforts in the South were so effective, was that they threatened boycotts against the merchants, and they carried out very effective boycotts. Merchants started losing money, and the merchants went to politicians and said, we got to do something about the situation, so they got concessions, they got voting rights. And the same thing's true, what we're dealing with now, whether it's dealing with keeping the net free and open, whether it's keeping the broadcast waves free and open, it's all a matter of putting bodies on the line, so to speak, whether it's in cyberspace or whether it's in the airwaves or whatever. It's a matter of numbers. and a willingness and commitment to take the risks necessary involved in doing this. And we're seeing this as, for me personally, I've been involved in broadcast and engineering electronics for quite a number of years. I've been a designer and for well over 20 years, both digital and analog, as well as raising the shelves I can in the streets. We need to use these tools as a tool of liberation. I've been involved in doing this for quite a number of years. What brought us to this point over the last couple of years was my total disgust over the media circus of the Gulf War, you know, the first multimedia war. Making it somehow palatable and acceptable to slaughter over a couple hundred thousand people in very horrible ways, fuel air bombs, for example, incinerating people who are trying to retreat from a war zone on a highway by dropping fuel air bombs on them, incinerating them on the spot. So at that point, we decided enough was enough, and we're going to try to do something about taking back the airwaves to somehow counter this incredible propaganda machine that's running in this country. So I went back to the design board, I went back to the CAD station, and started working on new designs and trying to make these things as small and portable and easy to put together as possible, yet effective technically and fairly technically clean as possible. So that's now evolved. We've, in the last year or so, we've seen the movement grow quite rapidly. The FCC, I don't think, quite knows what to do with us because they've never met any organized opposition of this sort. We work with the National Lawyers Guild for our legal defense, special committee on Democratic Communications, some very fine lawyers, some of the best legal people on the West Coast, who love nothing better to do than chew on the ankles of authority. If you're in a tight jam, try to find a guild lawyer to help you. They'll be there. They've been with us for many years on the streets, and they've been very good people to work with. We hope to be educating them as well in the next year to the Guild Committee efforts. I'll be at the National Lawyers Guild Convention in a couple weeks in Albuquerque, and we're going to be trying to bring the other guild attorneys up to speed, not only the broadcast legal issues, but on the whole issue of data communications on computers, on cryptography, et cetera, so that when people are hit with legal action by the government for their attempts to keep things free and open, there'll be legal help there who is up to speed on how to defend you, because we're going to need it, I'm sure, given the current direction of things in this country. So in the last year, we've seen our mailing list has now grown to approximately 1,500 people since the end of last summer. We're seeing stations sprout from small little towns in North Carolina to, I suspect, we'll see at least 4 to 6 stations going on in Seattle. We have two stations running we have one on right now, three at a Berkeley Golf. We're sort of taking a vacation, trying to get some things together. We'll be going back on in August. San Francisco Liberation Radio has been on the air now they've been on the air over a year, but they've now been on the air continuously, 7 nights a week, 2 to 5 hours a night, since the 1st of May without anyone busting down their door and not bringing them a fixed location. So we're going to have probably 2 more stations going on in San Francisco in different neighborhoods. We are also working internationally as well. These units have been supplied to various liberation struggles in other countries. Units similar to this was presented directly to subcontinent Marcos in Chiapas a couple of weeks ago. We have more transmitters going down there in a few weeks. We have other countries. We want to see every little campesino village in Central America from the Isthmus all the way up to Mexico, each village having its own little transmitter. Because we think this would be a very powerful tool. In fact, other countries have a more powerful tool than here because people are so tied into the TV reality, which we hopefully can do something about as well since we're working on TV transmitters, which will be out very soon. We have plans to keep going with this, regardless of whatever the FCC does. So we'll also be putting some packets up on the net, full technical packets. We have an FTP site, which is listed in the newsletter. It isn't full yet of stuff, but we're going to cram a bunch of stuff up there in the next week or so. So no matter what happens to us, we can have information. It'll be widely distributed, and anyone with a modicum of RF design experience can replicate what we're doing. We'll have complete board patterns and all that, so there shouldn't be a whole lot of problem replicating the designs. And what we like to do is we like to find people who might not necessarily want to put a transmitter on the air, but we're looking for technical mentors, because unfortunately the ability to roll your own, so to speak, electronically seems to be on the decline, and we want people to get back to more hands-on experience, to really making things so that people can feel a more sense of empowerment, because that's how one of the psychological tools that is used to defeat us is disempowerment. And people feel disempowered, and they bring in a whole another set of things as well, psychologically. And we want to create a sense of empowerment. People who may have never ever picked up a soldering iron, we can sit down and work with them and have them make a transmitter. And whether they go on the air or not with it is somewhat irrelevant at that point, because they've been empowered to do something they didn't think they could do. And that's very important in people's lives, that sense of accomplishment. We do have like a range of kits available, which are listed in our newsletter. We would like, help from other people in doing this work. We need legal help. We need organizational help. We're keeping a decentralized movement all across the country, educate people about the airwaves do belong to people. And we are dealing with First Amendment rights here. We're dealing with equal protection under the law. We are dealing with Article 19 of the Human Rights Convention that says people have the right to communicate with each other freely, unhindered in any manner. And we wanted to ensure that that's what's going to happen. Some of the ramifications, if you decide to do this, is that, well, the FCC can come in and threaten you with a fine. In our case, they seem to really jump the gun. They just go through the steps so you know what's going to happen. They just actually warn you first. If you cease and desist after a warning, then not much else is supposed to happen after that. They might more or less went from a nasty letter to saying, all right, you owe us $20,000 in my case. So, and they've done that in the other case with another person in San Francisco, but they're hitting for $10,000 most of the current liability. Both our cases are basically the same, and we're following the same legal strategy for both. And you can expect them to visit you for a number of reasons. The first being the interference of other services, and we're asking that so that they will succeed, that people do this, that they want, that they keep a clean signal, that they don't interfere with other services. The FCC always maintains, oh, only dual transmitters go on the air, they'll interfere with airplane communication, air-to-ground traffic, air nav, whatever, and airplanes will start falling out of the sky. The metaphors and arguments that they use in public are pretty ludicrous, even blaming the sinking of the Titanic on radio interference in the 20s or whatever. I mean, seriously, this is a metaphor that the head of the FCC used on the NPR program about a month ago. He said, well, actually somebody called in from Berkeley, got in and presented the argument for micropower broadcasting very well. And the FCC head Hunt, his name, responded, the reason these laws are because when the Titanic was sinking, it was harder for distress messages to get through. I'm like, huh? So they're not very good at PR, and they don't know quite what to do with this whole situation, in my opinion. But if you don't cause interference and if you use filters to keep your signal from getting harmonics into your neighbor's TV sets, because nothing pisses them off more than to have their Monday night football interrupted, and you can probably get away with for quite a while, particularly if the nearest field office is a few hundred miles away from you. They don't have the staff to send people running out all over the place to look for these things. It's not something they actively scan for, at least at the moment. So I think in the Bay Area, there's something, things running around. I think the complaints resulted from a local radio station. We're not sure who. We're doing a Freedom of Information Act to find out who it was. And it could be pretty interesting to find out who it was. I don't think it was one of the commercial operations. I won't say anything other than that. But the thing is that we can show that these can be done in a reasonable manner, that we don't cause malicious interference to other services, because quite frankly, the FCC's hierarchy of threat, so to speak, from this is rather low. In other words, this is something that doesn't cause that much problems for them in the first place. There are other things that they have to deal with that are on a scale of 1 to 10, much higher priority. And if we can keep it that way, we'll be in much better shape. So we encourage use of filtering. We're just now introducing a digital frequency control phase lock loop circuit that will keep your frequency rock solid, and all the units will be upgradable to that unit. And that's one reason we're doing this thing with the Free Communications Coalition. We want people to be technical mentors across the country to help people who want to go on the air but don't have the technical expertise to do it. So we're looking for people to volunteer who have experience in electronics, who can work with these sort of things and help people along, because we can't fly all across the country to help people get on the air. And we want to keep it decentralized. We want to spread the knowledge, spread the ability, so that if we get hit hard, they'll still continue. It's kind of overview, I guess, of what we're doing. I'll kind of open up for questions now and then take it from there. I'll kind of go back from the front.
Low impact, low power, because you want the low impact, so there'll be a bunch of them and they don't interfere with each other? Or is there a technical reason, or is there a science?
Okay, well, they aren't only 5 watts. We have them in different power ranges. What we're saying is that the power wattage should be appropriate to the community. In other words, if the housing project, like Mabana Kantako, with Black Liberation Radio, who's one of the first people really to keep, he's been on the air now for over 3 years, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, out of a housing project in Illinois, he started off with just a half a watt. He was just covering his housing project. Actually, he's not going to be covering his town of Springfield, because we have set him a 30-watt amplifier. but what we're saying is the power level should be low enough that it should cover the community that needs a voice. In other words, if it's a housing project, a half a watt, like it's been in a small town, might need a 5, well, actually, our new unit, we have a revised 5-watt design. It actually goes up to about 7 or 8 watts now. And I guess the rule of thumb we're saying is keep it appropriate to the community that needs the service. Because the problem is we have a limited amount of band space, largely due to the FCC's allowing these mega operations to go on. In San Francisco, we have a 100 kilowatt NPR station, KQED. And they bleed 3 channels up and 3 channels down because, front end, a lot of receivers aren't so hot. They just blow everything else off. So, and they've given 90-mile fringe protection to a lot of these stations. So there's holes, and to keep it as open as possible for people, our theory is keep your power sort of following the same guidelines as amateur radios. The guideline is you use this enough power to cover where you need to cover. Next person back there.
You ran through a list of things that the FCC is concerned about, what they're trying to avoid, like storm airwaves. Those all seem like pretty good ideas to me. And secondly, you said that you didn't think anybody would try to maliciously interfere with other channels. Whether it's malicious or inadvertent, interference is still something that needs to be, it should still cause equal damage.
Well, that's true, but an example of interference of a 100 kilowatt station in the middle of an urban area is blowing people's receivers 3 channels up and 3 channels down. And in terms of priorities, too, we're we're trying to do this in a technically reasonable manner, and I think there should be some, you know, some sort of process. But what we have is a situation that if your community wants to have a voice, you're going to spend a minimum at least $75,000 to $100,000 if you want to put an FM station on the air. With what we have here, you can put a fairly technically clean operation on the air for $600 or less. It's called equal protection under the law, but essentially 95% of people are denied a voice, you know, because they don't have the deep pockets of a corporate media interest behind them. And, you know, community interests should hold precedent over corporate interests, because we're dealing with a situation of right versus privilege, and rights should always outweigh privilege. And I grant there are technical problems, but that's the whole purpose of what we're doing, is to minimize the technical problems, minimize the interference through good design, and do this in a way. And of course, there are always going to be assholes who are going to do something stupid, but that's no reason that that this thing cannot continue. They can be dealt with, and it's done thing that's dealt with at the federal level. I mean, it's always community process. If someone's being a real jerk about it, people can go camp on their doorstep. That's the advantage of micro radio. If someone's acting like a real jerk about it, you can find them. I mean, this is easily, the FCC can find them. You can find them as well. You know, radio direction finding, asking every radio person, they'll tell you how to do RDF. And the advantage of that is you can go sit on their doorstep with a ticket sign saying this guy's a real jerk. Whereas if it's a corporate media entity, their boardroom may be 3,000 miles away, and you can't do that effectively. I'm saying it has to be brought down to local control. So if a community, you know, if someone's spewing absolutely hideous, you know, racist garbage, you can, from their bedroom, you can go camp on the doorstep and tell them what you think about it. That's what it's all about. Yeah, it's entirely programmable. In fact, it probably can. We're going to use it also as the frequency source for our UHF TV transmitters as well. I mean, we use the frequency multiplier. Let's see. So that goes to our next question tonight.
What kind of material do you broadcast on your station? How many people listen to it, and how do you advertise it to get new listeners?
Well, we've gotten a lot of local publicity, so that's how a lot of people hear about it. And a lot of neighborhood flyers go up in San Francisco. Since we've been sort of erratic in Berkeley lately because of this time requirement, I can't really speak to the Berkeley situation, although we do know at times we probably had maybe a couple hundred listeners in Berkeley in the area. Actually, we were covering a fairly good size of the Bay Area since we're up in the hills. We do know the San Francisco Liberation Radio, which has been on the air continuously now since May. I would guess our audience to be at least in several hundreds, if not more. A lot of people are coming up to people who are putting flyers up in the neighborhood and saying, oh, this is really great. We're really listening. So the response seems to be increasing. And if you consider the context of which some of this is happening, too. In San Francisco and a number of other Bay Area cities and even up down the West Coast, there's a really severe attack on poor people and the homeless, and they've come out with very draconian laws proposed. Can't sit on the sidewalk, can't panhandle after dark. I mean, this is like essentially basically the laws are unconstitutional. They're proposing, and have proposed in Seattle. They've completely banned putting up flyers, so people are trying to get about their band playing somewhere, whatever. People are being fined for just putting up flyers. I mean, this is really ridiculous. In San Francisco, it's even worse. We have people who are literally being beaten into the sidewalk for feeding the poor and homeless. It's called Food Not Bombs, the organization. And there have been over close to 800 arrests in the last 4 years of Food Not Bombs members for serving food to the poor and homeless in San Francisco, and the whole situation is escalating to the point that one of the main organizers is being essentially set up on trumped up felony charges so they can get in on three strikes and you're out. And we had this last week there was a pretrial hearing for him. There was a big gathering of people, about 300 some people, outside the Hall of Injustice in San Francisco. And there's lots of media there, but neither of the two major papers in San Francisco said a word about this. There was very little on any of the radio stations. One TV station, I think, maybe carried something. And at the same time, the gathering was going on, support was going on there. They feed at noon and at 5 or 6 o'clock every day outside across from City Hall. And at noon, people were serving food. And I guess the cops were rather pissed off about the wires showing a support for one of the other members that were all injusted. So they really wailed into the people serving food. They arrested them on felony conspiracy charges, to essentially felony conspiracy to create a misdemeanor. You know, felony conspiracy to commit lunch, basically. And there was one man who was there, was a street performer, street person, it was Paradox. Anyway, he does some sort of silent mime act with bowl of rice and chains. You gotta see it, you know. But anyway, the cops just jumped on him just mercilessly. They grabbed him around the throat, started choking him. He turned blue. He was thrown to the ground very hard. His forehead was gashed. There was blood everywhere, and he was thrown semi-unconscious into the back of a police wagon. And this was videotaped by three different people. There was a National Lawyers Guild group, fortunately next door to them, who, as a test thing, were serving food, and they weren't touched at all because they had suits and ties on. And so the videotapes were made available to the local media about what was going on, and none of this got airtime at all. The guild was fit to be tied. They had a press conference on Thursday, and there was nothing in the media about it, and they showed the videotape. There was nothing shown. This is kind of a long explanation, but just to give you context here. This is one of the reasons that San Francisco Liberation Radio is on the air, to expose this information to people about really what's going on, because we, Food Not Bombs, we work with also, because we hope to get their chapters across the country on the air. They have 50 chapters. A friend of mine is going back to Boston, who worked with me for the last year. He's going to be getting people on the air back on the East Coast. So that's the context. There's a lot of this stuff going on in this country that needs to be exposed for what it is. I mean, the fact that I travel outside the Bay Area and say people are being arrested for serving free food to the homeless, people get rather incredulous, like, huh? But this is happening. And the police brutality is incredible we have to face there. So that's some of the things that San Francisco Liberation Radio is talking about, bringing this stuff up.
You just continually talk about that, or
do
you play music in
between? There's all kinds of music. I mean, everything from Phil Oaks to Sister Soldier to to rap artists to it's basically pretty much the format of Free Radio Berkeley and San Francisco Liberation Radio is pretty much the same. We play a lot of stuff that has a message, has an attitude, and we also do a lot of news from the net, news that's not in the not going to be heard any other places. We pull regular news stuff off the net. It's actually a very good program mix, and particularly San Francisco Liberation Radio people are doing an excellent job. It's as good as anything you would hear on a Pacifica station, probably better now considering the downhill slide, the NPRization of the Pacifica outlets.
It's
a phase lock loop, it's a matter of reprogramming it. Yeah. Next row back there. Well, given the influence of corporate entities, I think such efforts would probably be useless. because we see what happens when we just want something basic as health care, what happens. And we just, and considering how much money is involved in the broadcast industry, I don't think we have a snowball's chance in hell of anything. And the Congress is bought and paid for by corporate America, and I don't have any illusions about that. We don't have democracy in this country. And in California, they're probably got the largest amount of money ever spent, and we spent on the Senate race with Dianne Feinstein, whoever the other idiot is. I don't have any illusion about Congress representing my interests or your interests at this point. Well, okay, antennas are the size, the physical size of an antenna is a function of wavelength. And there are a number of different antenna designs. Small switch would be a quarter wave antenna, which could be a quarter wave whip, which would be about 35 inches long on a mag mount on a roof of a car. That would be about your smallest type of antenna that you would get away with. We have other sizes. I mean, go way up to 5/8 ground plane, 5/8 a wave long, or J pole, Sungen types that are about 3/4 a wave long, about 97 inches. Essentially, your function is 11,811 divided by the frequency gives you a wavelength in inches. So, it's in the newsletter. It's the full address is ftp://crl.com. The directory is ftp://user/ro/frvsbd. It's in our newsletter. So how get a little box to how get in touch with us. Yes, we have in the, yes, about getting legal support from the Guild. We have in the publication, we usually keep it in each publication, a legal guide on what to do if the FCC knocks on your door. And the Guild is available for help in that area as well. And we hope to get more people involved from the Guild at this next convention coming up. So, talking about masking radiation patterns in antenna. Now we mostly generally work on the directional antenna, so masking or not. I'm sorry, what? Yeah, well, yeah, you can use a beam antenna. We actually, one thing we're looking at doing, and this actually, we would like some help for one aspect is from, you know, people who are good code hackers. I mean, I program, but it's just not my favorite thing to do. We're going to be working out a 900 megahertz, hopefully spread spectrum link kit, so you can remotely fly a transmitter somewhere else away from you and link to it. The other aspect of this is we want to make these also a wireless LAN packet unit, so people can set up their own wireless LAN packets in their own community. So you just basically plug it RS-232 port on your computer, run a cable to the antenna on the roof, and you can implement a wireless LAN packet system for your community. And that'll be one offshoot of that project. And if you want to get involved with that, writing the code and implementation, we would love to work with you on that. So people have asked questions before. Okay, well, person in black shirt on this side. Some of the stations are running. Some are running mobile, some are stationary. I'm not sure what the mix is. We hope with the next newsletter coming out, we'll get a little better idea of what people are doing. We're putting a request out now for people to at least send us an anonymous note or something, whatever, about you know, what they're doing, what frequency, what time, et cetera. But we aren't, you know, a lot of people, of course, want to keep it a little clandestine. Let's see.
You mentioned the FCC was trying to find you $20,000 or something. I don't know what the legal strategy is, but it would seem like to me you could say, you know, that the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution says you have the right to a trial by a jury on anything over $20, so you know, we're going to have a jury trial.
Right. Well, that's the thing is that we do have a rather weird legal situation where regulatory law has seemed to surpass common law and other aspects. So basically, as I understand the process, we go through administrative review through the FCC, and then they get fed up with us doing that, which could be 6 months, a year from now, 2 years from now, who knows. Then they go to a U.S. attorney and they ask for essentially a civil judgment against, again, without any evidence or proof to speak of. I mean, their evidence against me is extremely, I don't think it would stand up to any rules of evidence in any court system as far as I can tell. But then they go ask for judgment. Then because it's a civil situation, then we have to, that's where we get a trial, basically. And I agree that the whole thing is pretty specious, that we give these agencies the power to do this type of regulation without any due process. I mean, the whole justice system is set up in this country anyway, that perhaps you've heard you know, the aspect of what's called the jury nullification. That is, that whether you know it or not, and this totally freaks out judges, juries have the legal constitutional right not only to find a person guilty or innocent, they also have the legal right to judge the law itself, as whether that law was a fair law, whether that law is appropriate even for this case. And you try to bring that up, and judges totally flip out. They'll even declare a mistrial. And they are now attempting to charge people who are trying to inform people this right, particularly in active jury situations, of jury tampering. So the other thing is, you have to realize a lot of things you sign in this country, you say, well, this is a license. It's not really a license you're signing. You're actually signing a contract. And that's the same thing with FCC. You're not really getting a license when you go to get a broadcast station from them. You're actually signing a contract, and that contract basically signs away all constitutional rights. Person way in the back there. Asking about amateur radio community helping the FCC. That's true in some cases, and there are a lot of wannabe cops out there. So, you know, there are amateur radio people who, sometimes it's for hobbies, go track down people who are doing this with RDF gear. Since they don't have enforcement power themselves, they're just basically harassment, and they would be subject to stalking laws. You could get a court injunction against them for stalking if they persist in this. I mean, if people persist in that, I mean, there are states that have anti-stalking laws and various things that, you know, people are paying the ass about it. You can bring legal action against them for it. I mean, even though you're engaging, quote unquote, in legal activity yourself, they don't have any right to do it either. So it's kind of an interesting concept. But let's see here.
Got it.
You said that you think you have 200 listeners in the Bay Area. I'm curious how you determine that number.
This is a rough, this is for San Francisco Liberation Radio. This is sort of an offhand guess based on response people have gotten from putting up flyers. If you have people putting out flyers in the neighborhood, people coming up, 20 or 30 people within the space of a couple of hours from seeing people putting up flyers, coming up to people putting up flyers saying, hey, we listen to you, you just kind of figure out the math that, if there's 20, 30 people coming up directly, within that or a couple of hours to a person putting up the flyers in these neighborhoods, you can kind of figure out that maybe there's for every one of those, there might be 10 other listeners. This is sort of a, in direct mail, you send out a couple hundred thousand pieces and you get 2 or 3% response. They do call-ins and they get maybe 5 or 10 callers in the call-ins, but they extrapolate it for, 1 out of 10, 1 out of 20. This is a rough guess. There's, we don't have Arbitron for this. Although there was a rather humorous story about that. Another person I ran into actually when he was in the service in Texas was running a station for about a year, a little AM station running 25-50 watts out of a military installation. Commanding officers thought it was a neat idea. They didn't think that they gave them a building and a room for it, I guess the COs didn't know about FCC regulations. And this continued for over a year. So the station showed up in the Arbitron ratings for the next town. And, of course, the local broadcasters took great exception to this because they were apparently pretty popular. So, but I don't think we're going to see any of our operations ending up in Arbitron these days. But. Well, they're in the military, I guess. Okay, I'll take one or two more questions. That's a wrap.
Have you heard the ACLU
Not really. I quite frankly have found the ACLU to be, in certain exceptions in San Francisco, for the large part, the ACLU has been pretty silent on most of this. The only comment we ever gotten out of ACLU person on it was that when we were challenging this ban on amplified sound in People's Park in Berkeley, the university's been occupying forest at People's Park since it was liberated over 20 years ago, and they haven't liked that idea ever since. They've done everything they can to keep the situation under control. They have a permit process for amplified sound, so we said, well, okay, we're going to have a concert and, screw the forms. We're not going to use amplified sound. We're going to transmit it and ask everyone to bring a boombox. So, this is actually one area that's actually used. People are actually using these for raves now where they, it's just bullshit. Well, you can't get an amplified sound without permit, insurance, blah, 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 blah. It's like, give me a break. So a lot of ravers are asking people in San Francisco, they've done raves where they fill Bravo walk-in headsets and they have a stereo transmitter. So, I guess you get pretty weird stuff by doing something in the right channel, something in the left channel, and I don't know what they're doing exactly, but it's probably fun. But we're seeing this being used to get around sound permit requirements in public space. And when we did this in Berkeley last year, the newspaper that covered the story interviewed my ASOU, asked them a question. They, well, that's rather unique. We never even heard of this. Well, free speech. Well, I guess you haven't heard of that either. But, the ASOU is not known for essentially, ACLU wants to, in many cases, take on cases that that are sexy, that can essentially bring in large contributions in the mail. That seems to be one of the criteria. And same thing for Amnesty International, which is not investigating a lot of stuff going on in this country as well, because they don't want to offend their large U.S. funding sources. They over the some incredible situations are happening in Mississippi. I mean, it's like South Africa. There are a lot of young men in Mississippi jails that are mysteriously hanging themselves with their hands tied behind their back. The Amnesty International internal memo was leaked out saying they didn't want to go on a fishing expedition in Mississippi because that would be too embarrassing to their American contributors to find out that Mississippi is no different from South Africa 2 years ago. Well, if no further questions, that we'll wrap this up with the next speakers go on. As I said, we have a technician table back there, and we'd be happy to give information and anything else you might need. Thanks.